This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9.
Freshly dug Joycast.
And this special hour, we're talking with filmmaker Tony Ayres. Now, what was that piece of music we just heard, Tony, and why did you pick it?
Yoshimi and versus the Pink Robots by Flaming Lips, and
just because you like it, or does it have some particular significance for you?
I guess the main significance is that I hadn't listened to music for years, and I was going for a walk and having coffee with my friend Paul McDermott from Good News Week, and he's much more savvy with music than me. Mm-hmm. And I just said to him, you know, what should I listen to? And he pointed to Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots and said, this is what you have to listen to. And I got really excited. I picked it up and I listened to it and I really loved it and I got really excited because I thought at last I was listening to something vaguely current. And yeah. Then I looked at the back and it was out in 2002. I feel like a bit of a musical dinosaur.
Well, you know, you've got to catch up sometime.
Well, I need people to advise me. I get my friends to tell me what to listen to.
I know nothing about contemporary music either. The only lessons I get are actually being here at this radio station and listening to what people play.
Yeah.
Now, you've had an incredible life story, I think it's fairly fair to say, which in fact is now fairly well known. At least part of it is fairly well known because you put it all in a movie.
Yes, yeah.
Which is your most recent movie, which was Home Song Stories. You talked to, which was mainly about your mother.
Yes.
And about your childhood. I don't want to go through that in any huge detail because I think that's pretty well known to more or less everybody. But can you just kind of give us a sense of, you know, where that left you after you went through all that? I mean, your mother came here from Macau in the early 70s.
Mid-60s.
Yeah. Which cannot have been easy for a Chinese woman coming to Australia at that time. You had a very troubled family life, I think it's fair to say. Your mother killed herself. The only constant that seems to have been there throughout your childhood was your sister. You more or less had to sort of survive from a very early stage, didn't you? You had to kind of find your way to survive from quite an early age.
Yeah, I think that's all true. I think one of the things about people who survive traumatic backgrounds is that I think studies have shown that if there is some constant figure in their lives, that actually is very important in terms of being able to form a sense of identity and to feel safe. And I think I was very lucky because I have a very loving relationship with my sister who is 6 years older than me. And really, she was the one who bore the brunt of my mother's, both my mother's love and her madness.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that kind of upbringing gave you an independence you might not have otherwise have had?
I think it prepared me for a career in the film industry.
Because I listened to an interview you did on The Conversation Hour, and you made a big thing about stability. You talked about you needed stability in your life because of this chaotic, this roller coaster kind of beginning you had, and your sister provided it for one part of your life, and now your partner provides that. You've been with your partner an awful long time.
Yeah. I think that... Really, I think people respond very differently to trauma. I mean, you know, we're all different, and I think my response to it, having you know been through these very difficult teenage years with my mother and the kind of dramas around it, which was the basis of my film, The Home Song Stories. I don't think I actually consciously sought out you know a stable relationship, which would be the relationship that would last me for the rest of my life or anything like that. I didn't really sort of think I was doing that, but what happened was that the first person I formed a relationship with at the age of 17 is still my partner. So that, you know, I guess it's a combination of seeking out something that you need. So, like, so I think sometimes people do that. And luck, good luck, really.
Yeah, because, I mean, for anyone wanting a stable life, going into anywhere in the arts, and in particular into movie making, is not exactly the place to be, is it?
No, not at all.
And yet you've always worked.
I've been very lucky, yeah. I've
So you must be good.
I have had a very fortunate career. Really, from the time I left film school in Sydney... until now, really, I had about 12 months where I had to work at a cinema to supplement my income. But apart from that, I really haven't had a single day of unemployment as a filmmaker. And I think that's kind of extraordinary.
Well, I think you're either extraordinarily lucky or you are very good, because and you have to be very good, I think, because a lot of people who are very good don't get that kind of break, and do spend long periods between jobs, as it were. But I mean, you cover a wide range of things, don't you? You don't just make feature films.
Yeah. I mean, I am a little bit of a jack of all trades, and I also, the truth is, when I left film school in the late 80s, I was one of the things that I was really lucky to find was that there was an interest at that time in hearing stories about Chinese-Australian migrants. And so I had some pretty powerful personal stories which I wanted to tell. And so those two things came together pretty well.
Yeah, you make very personal movies, don't you?
So far. You can only go do that for so long, though.
Well, they say everybody's first book is a biography.
Yeah.
And everybody's first movie, I suppose, is to some extent. And then you move on from there, as it were. Let's go back a little bit to why you went to film school in the first place. What made you choose that as your route through life, as it were? Why that?
Well, I guess everything kind of reduces back to childhood and in some shape or form. And I know that both my sister and I were huge fans of the cinema when we were kids. And I found myself always caught up in reading and in going to the movies, and I really liked escapist fantasy, and, you know, there's you don't have to be Einstein to put those two together.
No.
But, you know, like, I like things that took you into other worlds.
Yes.
And my sister did as well. She was obsessed with Gone with the Wind. She she went to see it 18 times.
Oh, Lord.
And she took me 3 times before I reached puberty, which... I don't know what that created in me.
Yeah. I think you had a lucky escape somehow.
But, film was something I really loved. Although, actually, when I went to university, I was actually probably more interested in being a writer. I really loved writing prose, and I used to write short stories.
Mm.
And I have edited... a couple of volumes of short stories, and also contributed short stories to a number of anthologies.
Mm. And you still write scripts too, don't you? That's another.
I try to. I haven't written for a while, but certainly.
And edit other people's.
Sorry.
And yes, other people's.
I work with other people's scripts, and I tend to work more as a director and a producer these days.
It's been a. I guess someone who comes from a sort of chaotic background like yours needs something to make sense of it. And you've found a way of making sense of it by telling it in story form.
Yeah.
Someone once said to me that they wrote because while it was still in their head, it was something that they worried about. But once they turned it into a piece of prose or a film, or, you know, they got it out of themselves and they put it down on paper, it was almost like laying demons to rest for them. It didn't get rid of it, as it were, but it kind of framed it and put it in a context and gave it a place.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly something very, very therapeutic in the writing process in terms of, I guess therapy is also about trying to understand and contextualize, you know, things that have happened, things that you've done, things that have been done to you, and the weird thing about writing about yourself is that when you're doing it, you actually stop writing. It's not you that you're writing about. You create the character of you. And I think that most writers who write in the first person actually are writing in character. So even on a film like...
So you're inventing yourself. You are reinventing yourself as you go along.
Even in a film like The Home Song Stories, which was very personal, I never really thought of myself as that boy in the film, even though I knew I was that boy. I thought of him as a separate character. And you kind of have to as well.
The distancing.
Yeah.
In order to do it, yeah.
That starts in the writing process and in the directing process, it becomes even more
I can't begin to imagine this.
yeah, it just becomes bigger.
Yeah, I can't begin to imagine doing that. Let's take a little break here and hear some more music. What's the next piece we got lined up here?
I think it's Gabrielle. it's a song called Sunshine.
And why did you pick this one?
It just always makes me happy.
That's as good a reason as any. Gabrielle, Sunshine. That's the trailer there for Home Song Stories, probably the currently, at any rate, the best known of films made by my special guest today on Digging Deeper, Tony Ayres. Now, before we play that little piece of music there, we were talking about the whole process of creating this movie, which is taking your life and then writing it down and, in a sense, rewriting yourself as a separate character. I think that was illustrated very well in that clip there. You said... The character said, let me get this right, I have to be careful here, you gave a number of reasons in that clip there for writing the story, to understand and ultimately to love. Was that your motivation or the character's motivation?
That was probably the character's motivation because the character needed a motivation, whereas I didn't, you know, mine could have been more mercenary, like I knew it would make a good film, I could get the money for it, but what's interesting is that ultimately, through the process, I probably learnt a lot of the things that the character learned.
Very, very much a piece of therapy then.
No, it was never intended as therapy, but I certainly got something from it.
Does it make it easier to talk about your past and to talk about your mother, or harder?
I've never been troubled by talking about it. Yeah, I don't feel like it's a big secret. Anyway,
well, certainly isn't that anymore.
Yeah,
no, not,
yeah, and
not for
and
a long time.
I kind of never was really. I've written stories about my mother in the past, and she has been a figure in my work right throughout my career. That character has recurred in a number of different forms.
Oh, and one's tempted to say all gay boys love their mothers. now let's get away from Home Song Stories. Let's go back a little bit. What was your first commercial project?
I'm still waiting for it.
Oh, you mean people don't go see the movies?
hey, I'm an Australian filmmaker.
I mean, because you've certainly won lots of prizes and things.
Yeah. I've done very well critically.
All right, what was your first professional project then, if you don't like the word commercial?
The very first gig I got was out of film school, was actually to make a documentary for Channel 4 called Double Trouble. At that stage, they had a queer show called Out on Tuesday, and Double Trouble was a half-hour documentary about gay and lesbian Aboriginal people. And it screened on SBS and was a Channel 4 SBS co-production.
Now, Channel 4 being the British...
The UK Channel 4, sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, I would know, not necessarily everybody out there would know. So you started with a gay theme.
Yes.
Have gay themes always been very prominent in your work? That's something else you've never hidden?
Yeah, they seem to be. Really, the trajectory of my work for you know, probably the last couple of decades has been around questions of identity, issues around gay identity, and also issues around Asian Australian identity, and that they're the recurring themes of the work that I've done to date. I wouldn't say that that's what I'm going to continue working on, but certainly because I feel like I've kind of ploughed that field till it's fairly fallow now. But it's certainly been the thread through both my documentary and my fiction work.
You say Asian Australian. Which are you more, do you think? Because you sound utterly Australian, obviously, because you came here at a very young age.
And I've got a cold, so I'm a bit more nasal.
Oh, it's because you have a lovely deep voice. It sounds wonderful on the radio, I can tell you. You'll have boyfriends lining up if ever you were coming spare, I think, after today. The whole thing about having a dual identity is what I want to get to, this sort of Asian, Australian thing. Did you have to kind of go back and discover an Asian identity, given that you were brought up mainly in Australia?
Yes, absolutely. I came from a very assimilationist period. So my mother didn't particularly want me to speak Chinese, mm-hmm. even though she couldn't really speak English that well. So, as I got older, I stopped being able to communicate to her.
Well, that happens with parents and children anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah. It just became more profound because we didn't even speak the same language anymore. But I think that you know, and...
Do you speak Chinese now?
No, not
you've
a
never,
word.
You've never learned?
No. Well, I tried to, but I just couldn't get past ni hao ma. I was a shocking student.
I'm told it's a ferociously difficult language to learn unless you're brought up with it.
What I was told was I had really good accent and really good tones, but I had no retention for the words. And I think it's just because I work with words most of the time anyway. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have enough space to kind of cram in other words. But
Chinese culture, I mean, have you investigated that in any way?
I was brought up around Chinese restaurants. And what I was saying earlier is that all through my 20s, I think I didn't ever think of myself as Chinese. I thought I was very much a white person who had yellow skin, a banana, I guess. Uh-huh. And I made a documentary called China Dolls, which was very much about this subject.
Yeah.
And it was only really in my 30s when I was employed by the ABC to write a mini-series called The Wives of Kwong, which was a six-hour expansive mini-series about the Chinese in Australia, a drama. And unfortunately, it never got made, but it was a wonderful project. And in that, I actually had to do this crash course in what it was to be Chinese in Australia. Like, up until my significant 20s, probably my mid-20s, I didn't even realize that there was more than one Chinese language. You know, like, I was really that dumb. And or in denial. And so, you know, like, I really had to understand Chinese culture in Australia, and I did find it fascinating, and found through it, I started recognizing aspects of my personality, aspects of my sensibility, which kind of made sense, which I hadn't ever given the label of Chinese before. But, you know, I think there are certain parts of me which are very, very Chinese.
Yeah, it's obviously something very difficult for someone like someone who's white and was always brought up as white and is white, or if you're brought up entirely within your own culture, whatever it may happen to be, it's very difficult to get your head around the concept that, you know, I've heard black people say, you know, I didn't really think I was black, you know, because it wasn't an issue at home if they'd been raised in a mixed race environment. And then they went out into the wider world and it was other people who taught them that they were black because they reacted to them differently and they didn't really understand that. And it took time to come to grips with that. Did that happen with you?
I was at university in a very lefty, middle class kind of milieu, a bunch of really close friends, and often they would say to me that they forgot I was Chinese.
Mm.
And the only time I actually was aware that I was Chinese was when I went out into the gay scene, because I didn't actually because I went to university in Canberra. There wasn't really much of a gay scene there.
Mm.
It was only when I moved to Melbourne in my mid-20s and...
And then you crashed straight into the stereotype.
Well, which I had surprisingly been very ignorant of.
Mm.
And then I kind of realised, well, if you're Chinese or Asian in the gay scene, that particularly in those days, although I still think it's relevant now, because the gay scene is so much about the way people look, you know, people are judged by the way they look, and, you know, you can't avoid being Chinese there, you know.
That's one way to put it. Did that disturb you?
Oh, I found it really perplexing and distressing, because I guess back in that time, people were kind of interested in you if they wanted to have sex with you. Really, that was the kind of standard currency of negotiation within the gay context, I think,
most of the time, isn't it?
And I found myself really largely ignored and feeling very kind of invisible within that world. I mean, fortunately, I was in a relationship and I had a very stable and loving partner, and but well, you know, I'd still like to go out, and I was younger, and I liked to have, and I had a appetite to party, certainly, and but
you found yourself kind of getting pigeonholed.
It was problematic, it was a problematic situation, and that's what China Dolls, the documentary, was actually about. It sort of talked about both of those things of not really accepting being Chinese, and then finding I would go into the gay scene and be like really Chinese.
Yeah, there's nothing like other people defining you, is there, to drive you to want to define yourself even more, I should think. Personally, I hate being pigeonholed, but far I haven't made a movie or written a book. Maybe I should. Let's have a little bit more music now. This is End of the World by Matt Olber. What made you pick this one?
It's a very romantic, gay kind of ballad. And someone sent it to me on YouTube, and I really loved it. And sort of explored Matt Olber as a singer, and it's his only good song.
Well, at least you found the good song. At least you found the one good song. That's Matt Olber, End of the World. And this is Doug Pollard. This hour we're digging deeper with filmmaker Tony Ayres. Now, he doesn't just make movies, however. He's tried his hand at plays, and he's done some television, a fair bit of television too, as we were just hearing. But I was going through his bio. One of the pleasures of interviewing someone like Tony is that there's a vast amount of information about him on the internet, so I'm not sure what things to talk about. And I came across your first play was called The Fat Boy.
Yes, that's right.
And you said of that, at a certain point I realised I couldn't keep writing about gay Chinese people, so I tried my hand at fat people. More outsiders.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I was kind of always drawn to the story of the outsiders, and I guess I also felt that I noticed that, like, fat people in the gay scene are all... you know, like the thing that really kind of affected me in my 20s was when I'd sort of look at the ads in the personals, and it'd say no fats, femmes, and Asians.
Yes,
and I just always wanted to write a character who was a fat, femme, Asian. But
you certainly did here. He's described as being fat, effeminate, gay, cowardly, and trailer trash.
Yeah, he's not Asian though, but he's kind of he is trailer trash. And I really loved writing it. It was put on at the Malt House, and it was funny. It was kind of tragic comedy. Probably, if I got to do it again, I would sort of make it a purer comedy. There's a very tragic element in it, which I don't know how successful I was in getting those two things to sit together, but it certainly had some of the funniest lines I've ever written in it. So I
Well, you got to have fun for at least part of it.
It was a lot of fun, yeah.
Now, you continued with Fat Bogans with the TV series that's recently finished. Bogan People, is it?
Bogan Pride.
Bogan Pride.
Yes.
Now, I'd heard about this and the title alone turned me off, though I hadn't bothered with it before. But knowing we were going to talk today, I watched a little of some snippets and things on online last night, and I have to say I was frankly quite appalled by a lot of it. A big fat girl by a swimming pool singing about trimming the hair that was coming out of her swimming costume in inappropriate places in some profusion. Where did that project come from? Did someone come to you and say, let's make a series about Bogans? Or was it your own idea? Or?
That wasn't our project. What happened was I have always been a big fan of Rebel Wilson since her days as Tula at Fat Pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And someone introduced me to her, and she asked me to have a read of her scripts. And I did, and I kind of helped her develop the scripts. And along the way, I kind of fell in love with her and her take on the world. And asked whether my partner, Michael, and I could produce it as a TV series.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. I mean, listen, it was the first time we'd ever done anything like it.
You know, the first time anyone's done anything like it.
Well, ironically, even it rated pretty well for SBS.
Yep.
And Rebel's gone to America with it. And they absolutely love it over there. And she got a development deal with Ben Stiller's company. She's now working with... she's got a role in Judd Apatow's latest film, and it all comes from Bogan Pride. We actually even... One of the producers of Desperate Housewives actually offered us the remake rights.
It has... you know, looking at it now that we've got Glee on Australian television, you can look at that and you can see, you know, the mean girls and the fat girl and all the rest of it. You see something of a similar sensibility there, but translated into an Australian context. So I guess it would be recognisable to Americans.
Well, it would be more like if John Waters did Glee.
Mm.
Yeah, it's fairly bizarre and full of vagina jokes.
Yeah, you said it's very...
Which is not... That doesn't... They didn't come from me, by the way.
I wouldn't for a moment suggest they did, Tony. You say it's very popular with 11-year-olds.
Yes. When we were making...
Vagina jokes.
When we were making it, we thought that it was kind of like, you know, 15, 16 kind of, you know, a younger audience. Certainly a younger audience.
Yeah.
And I was a bit startled to find that the kids I knew who were in their late years at school didn't like it all, thought it was terrible. but the kids who really liked it were the 11 and 12-year-olds. And it's got a cult following amongst them and airline hostesses and hosts.
Cabin crew.
Yes, cabin crew.
That's to be politically correct here. Yes. Cabin crew.
Yes.
I'm not going to try and stitch that together.
No, well, you know,
11-year-olds and cabin crew is a weird combination.
Some of these
combination.
Things you just don't want to think too much about.
No, definitely not. Was it fun?
Yeah, it was great to do comedy. Yeah,
because I mean, it looked like you had fun with it.
I mean, it's still hard. It's hard because when you make things in Australia, you're always making things on low budgets and with not enough time, not enough resources. So it had all of those caveats, but.
Yes, I saw.
It was a great experience.
Yeah, I saw someone complaining about in one of your movies. You let the microphone boom come into shot, and you know, what's up? Couldn't they afford to cut that bit? You know, and I thought, yeah, that's probably the answer. That
possibly
you couldn't afford to cut that bit. The working with television and working with film—they're very different beasts, aren't they?
Yeah.
Is it easier to get the money together for television, to get backing, to put that together? Because it always seems to me that putting a film together is an incredibly complex and long-winded business.
Yeah.
Someone has an idea for a movie in like 1990-something and it gets made in about 2010, you know. Is television easier?
I think...
shorter development times?
Yeah, television tends to have shorter development times and tends to finance earlier. So, and because most of the money comes from one broadcaster, it is a simpler financing model.
Mm.
The truth is, at the moment in the world, there is an oversupply of feature films. There are more feature films available for the cinemas than there are people who really want to go to films.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real struggle to get a film onto the screens and to keep it on the screens mm-hmm. long enough for people to know about it and for it to find its audience.
And then, of course, you're up against this juggernaut that comes from America.
Exactly.
There must be only a limited amount of screen real estate available for anything that isn't coming out of Hollywood.
You have those big tentpole American films that not only take up the screen space, they take up the advertising space, they take up the press interest. They're the things that dominate our cinema, and then we have kind of good old Aussie battle of films that try to provide an Australian audience with a different experience, and so that's kind of a tough landscape to fit into. I mean, we have,
so it's a bit of a relief to go and do a TV series in a sense, because you don't have to do all that struggle.
It's a different kind of struggle. It's a different set of relationships, but we've had pretty good relationships with the broadcasters we've worked with, mainly SBS and the ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, given us really intelligent collaboration. So we've been pretty lucky so far.
Well, let's just talk about... We're talking a bit about your things you've done in the past. You've got something new coming up, but this is not something you've directed. This is something you've produced.
Yes.
Now, for those out there who don't know, what does a producer do? Just stitch the whole deal together?
The producer wears many hats, really, there are different kinds of producers.
So what did you do?
I tend to be a creative producer, so I worked with the writer and director on the script and sort of talked to her about casting. The writer and director is a woman called Belinda Chaco.
Mm-hmm.
The film is called Lou, and it stars John Hurt and from Elephant Man and Naked Civil Servant, and
I think we all know who John Hurt is.
A million other things. We had dinner with him one night, and I was talking about all these films that I really loved, and he would just sort of look back and wryly and say, oh yes, I was in that.
Yeah, he's one of those who's turned up in a lot of things, sometimes not very well advisedly.
He's in everything, every film ever made.
Well, he's like you, he's never stopped working.
I think he's got...
got a slightly higher profile.
More houses and wives than me.
slightly higher profile. So what's the movie about? It says, Lou, love is all we need.
Yes. It's a story about an 11-year-old girl. It's set in Moolumbah in northern New South Wales. She lives with her mother and her two sisters, and it's pretty tough. Their father's just walked out on them. And then into this mix comes her paternal grandfather, played by John Hurt, who has Alzheimer's, and he misrecognizes Lou, the 11-year-old Lou, as his wife Annie.
Mm.
So he starts to romance her, and she plays along with it because it's a game, because it suddenly gives her power in the house against her mother, who she's kind of in a very truculent relationship with.
Mm, sounds like a fascinating story.
It's actually surprisingly tender and actually really poignant, because there's this game that goes on, and there's also an element of danger, because you never quite know when John is going to step over the line, if he's going to step over the line.
Yeah.
But it's a very poignant story, because they actually are both grieving and they offer each other something.
Well, if you'd like to see this movie, Tony has very kindly brought us two double movie passes to see Lou, and which opens when? Opens on the 17th.
Yes, Thursday, 17th of June.
Opens on the Thursday, 17th of June, starring John Hurt. And as I say, you must be an existing member who has not won a prize in the last 2 weeks, or a new member willing to sign up now with a credit card over the phone. That's double passes to Lou. And all you have to do is give us a call on 1-300-JOY-949. That's 1-300-569-949 to win double passes to the new movie that produced by Tony Ayres, Lou. And thank you very much for that, Tony.
That's a pleasure.
Now, let's have another little piece of music. Zombie?
Yes.
You're not one of these people who sort of puts up makeup and shuffles around the streets, are you?
Not anymore. This is by the Jay Brannon version of Zombie. Mm-hmm. Jay Brannon is this beautiful gay singer-songwriter who has a bit of a cult internet following. I discovered him through a friend sending me a song of his, which I absolutely loved.
You all get all your music from other people.
Exactly.
You don't have time to listen to it yourself.
It's all by recommendation.
Well, you must have some good friends. This is Jay Brennan and Zombie. And this is Doug Pollard bringing it to you. Digging deeper this hour with filmmaker Tony Ayres, who very kindly gave us two double passes to give away to the new movie he's produced, starring John Hurt, called Lou. And I'm happy to say that Cameron of Albert Park and Alan of St Kilda have scored a double pass each, thanks to Tony. Tony, you've got quite a lot of other things on at the moment, or coming up in the near future. First off, you've got, you're making The Slap, the Christos
Chokas,
I never pronounce that, book. You're making that into a TV series.
For the ABC, yes. We're just financing at the moment. We're just starting to cast. I'm producing with Helen Bowden and Michael McMahon as part of a new company called Matchbox Pictures, which we all formed a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a very exciting project. There's a huge amount of interest in the book.
Yes.
And we're doing, using the same structure as the book, 8 chapters, 8 points of view.
Hmm. In 8 episodes?
In 8 episodes, yes.
And when is that likely to hit the screens, do you think?
Probably next year, some stage.
Next year, some. You've also got a documentary series on hand, Anatomy Series 2. What's that about?
These are 3 half-hour documentaries that we do for the ABC, and they're very queer. One of them we did last year was called Skin, and it was all about Jeff Osling, the guy who had a total body tattoo.
Oh, yeah.
And it was about him trying to arrange for when he dies that he wants to donate his skin to the National Gallery. So, and that was hugely successful, that one. And
should have himself plastinated by that German guy.
We might put the two together and do the next show.
Yeah.
And so this is a second series. One of the films is about the sister girls, the Tiwi Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful documentary about that community through the eyes of a photographer. It's they're on 10 o'clock on Tuesday nights at the on the ABC. They have an arts slot and they're part of the arts programming slot there.
Sister girls being transgender.
Yes.
We were talking about this earlier on with one of my other guests, Daniel Whithouse, and he said sister girls means different things in different parts of Australia, but in general terms we're talking about transgenders.
Transgender in an Indigenous community.
Indigenous community. And you're also putting in an appearance at the Brisbane Festival as well. What are you doing there?
I wrote a stage show called Shanghai Lady Killer, which has its world premiere at the Brisbane Festival this year. And it's basically a cross between Blade Runner and Crouching Tiger. It's a martial arts movie on stage. And it's with acrobats and dancers and a theatre company called Stalker are doing it, and directed by Rachel Swain and Roger Hodgman.
That sounds a bit like a Chinese opera.
It's got elements of Chinese opera in it. It's got elements...
Better music, I hope, to Western ears anyway.
It has a very Western score, yes.
Because I've been to see a couple of Chinese operas and, I sat through about an hour and I enjoyed the visual side of it. The audio side of it, I think you have to have Chinese ears.
It's a particular sensibility, yes.
It is. And the future going forward... After all this is out of your hair, Where do you see yourself in, say, about 5-10 years' time? Are you still going to be making movies
here
about,
again?
Still going to be making movies about your past and about your history, or will you have picked up Hollywood's tab by then? Do you think?
The next film that I want to make is a thriller with a sort of love triangle at the centre. Mm-hmm. So set in this around the bombing of the Whiskey A Go Go in Brisbane,
mm-hmm.
and at some stage I'd like to write a musical.
Oh, we'll have to introduce you to Will Conyers at Broadway at bedtime here, and he can put you in touch with all the right people.
Oh, well, yeah, I love musicals. So probably less personal, a little bit more audience friendly,
mm-hmm.
Less art house stuff for a while. But you never really know. It's an industry that changes very quickly,
and you never know what is going to become a hit. Quite often,
yeah.
You may not have made it with that intention, but it catches the public imagination.
We hope so.
Yeah, hope so. In fact, quite often when you're going down that particular route, you do better than if you're cynically playing for the mass audience, I think.
Yeah, well, I don't quite know how to do that, because I, for instance, I would talk to my partner about what I think is a really commercial idea, and he'd just look at me and shake his head.
You work together then?
He's part of the
business, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes. Michael used to be a lawyer, and mm-hmm. And now he's a film producer. For my sins, he's a film producer.
Talk about changing other people's lives.
Yeah.
You obviously love what you do. You've got
massive
enthusiasm for what you do. And you've won all sorts of prizes for your movies. We didn't talk about Walking on Water, which I wanted to get to, but never mind, we're running out of time, we can't. You won prizes at the AFI, you won prizes overseas as well. You sound to me as though you're going to try and make a movie that people come to as well. Because in the past, it's often been said, you know, Australian films often win lots of awards, but they don't win big audiences.
That's been my experience of the films I've made so far.
Yeah. So hopefully the next one out of the blocks will be the one to hit the funny bone, so to speak.
You just have to make the thing that you care about and hope that you can make it into something that people can also care about.
Which is all you can do at the end of the day. Tony, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Doug.
And we got one more piece of music to play us out with. Janet Jackson, Together Again. Any particular reason? Or was this another one that a friend recommended for you?
That was a beautiful moment. I think it was at the Gay Games or something. They played this, or won Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was the theme song for Mardi Gras, and I remember it was a lot of fun.
Okay, well, Tony Ayres, thank you for being my guest today on Digging Deeper. And this is Janet Jackson, Together Again.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.